Yes, so tonight we're going to go a bit more old school. No PowerPoint, no prezzies, nothing. Open the Bible in front of you, you'll find there's Bibles. No notes, nothing. We're just going to talk tonight. You'll see there's Bibles in front of you, NIV versions. Right, we're going to look at the book of Hebrews. We're not going to get through it, obviously. But I'm going to start at a couple of places there. We'll see how far we get for tonight. And then we'll continue. We won't continue too long of it, but a couple of things I'd like to point out. Maybe you can open the main portion of Scripture we're going to read is in Hebrews 7. That is page 278 of the Bible I've got in front of me. Most of you should have the same one. If not, you're looking for Hebrews 7. You would also want to open at Hebrews 1. But it's obviously a couple of pages before that, and Hebrews 12. We're just going to look at a verse in Hebrews 1 and a verse at Hebrews 12, but Hebrews 7 is going to be the main kunain that we're going to look at tonight. All right, everyone ready? You're awake. Not awake, Martin. You're awake. All right, let's go. So the book of Hebrews. Book of Hebrews is a tricky one to read, isn't it? Homework for this week, read the book of Hebrews. But don't do it before you go to bed because you're going to struggle. All right, read it when you're awake. It is a tricky book. It is a tricky book to read. Initially, we don't know what is the title of the book of Hebrews. It was first called the book of Hebrews by Clement of Alexandria. That's about 200 years after Christ. It was written probably before 70 after Christ. So it was written quite early. But we actually don't know what it was called. When Clement called it the book of Hebrews, he called it that because it was written to people that is obviously very familiar with Jewish traditions. Very familiar. In fact, if you read through the book, there's so much references to Jewish life and the Jewish way of doing things at that stage, looking at the temple in particular and looking at the high priest and the priesthood in particular, that it's actually quite hard to follow. Half of the time you're going like, what? What's going on here? What is he trying to say here? What is the story there? And it's written to people that was very familiar with this. So in all likelihood, it was written to Jewish Christians. In all likelihood, it was written to people that's very much in the know how the Jewish way of life happened, how they really worshipped God, and how that then fits in with Christ. But in particular, the group of people it was written to was a group of people that were struggling. You see, this was a group of people that really knew their stuff. It's written in very complicated language. If you go and read the Greek, it is a hard book to read. I had to read that for my studies. It's not that easy to read it. Sweating bullets. Yes. All right. It is written in difficult language. It is very eloquent. It's very in detail. It's very technical. And the author of it writes, and it says, you ought to be teachers. In other words, it's writing it to people that's very much in the know. We are talking about people that has been followers of Christ for quite a while at least, or they're very knowledgeable about how to follow Christ. All right? In our context, if we have to put it around for today, I would say this is a book very much written to people that's been Christians for quite a while. So maybe it's written to you tonight. And what was the big issue here? What was the big problem? Why was it written to this group of people? It was written to this group of people because they were slowly but surely walking away from Christ. Now, somebody once asked me, what is the best thing about the type of work that I do and what is the worst thing? That's a questionnaire we had to fill in for the website when we put that up years ago. And one of the questions we had to put up there about like a personal type of thing that you can say what you like and what you don't like. And one of the questions was, what is the best and what is the worst thing of the work that we do? The best thing, I had to think a bit about that. For me personally, the best thing of what we do is to see how somebody's lives change. That's amazing. It's just amazing to see what God can do in people. It's amazing. You know what's the worst thing? The worst thing is when somebody walks away. Now, let's see. How long has people been followers of Christ here, more or less? Let's have a look. Who's been following Christ less than 5 years? Let's put it that way. Less than 5 years. Following Christ less than 5 years. Okay. Who's been following Christ between 5 and 10 years? Let's have a look at that. All right. Who's been following Christ between 10 and 15 years? Okay, between 15 and 20 years. All right, longer than 20 years. Die harde baarde. The longer you follow Christ, you start noticing something. You start noticing people that really, really follow Christ, and then something happens, and they walk away. I first joined this church, not this congregation, Shofar's a church group. I joined it in 1997. At that stage, I was preaching already. I was baptized in the Spirit already for 3 years. And I was going for it. And I saw amazing people when I came to this church. That's what really hit me at this church. That's what really convicted me about being at this church, the people that was there. I saw amazing people that were doing amazing things. And some of them are not following Christ anymore. Now that's a hard thing I'm saying today. Don't worry, tonight is good news. It's not bad news. Don't worry. But I want to be real about things as well, right? Have you noticed something like this? Have you seen it? I've seen it. And it's probably the worst part. It's probably the hardest part of what we do. See, now we don't know who was the author of the book of Hebrews. I mean, it's actually written in a very interesting way. It's not written like the other epistles. The other epistles, normally there's an introduction, there's a greeting, and the person identifies himself. Doesn't happen with the book of Hebrews. We don't know who was the author of the book of Hebrews. Some says maybe it was Paul, but it's not written in the same style that Paul normally writes. Some says that it's Luke. We don't know. Some says that it's maybe Apollos. In the Bible, we heard him mentioned at least twice as a very eloquent speaker. And this is certainly a very eloquent book. We don't know. Somebody actually made a theory, very interesting theory, that it's a woman that writes the book of Hebrews, and she obviously didn't put a name in it because it was a bit tougher for the ladies in those days, right? So one of the theories is that Priscilla actually wrote it, who was the person that mentored Apollos, and Apollos was he was a hot shot. So if Priscilla mentored him, then she knew her stuff. We don't know. Cebius, the early church historian, writes, and he says, God only knows. Wrote the book of Hebrews. The fact is, the book of Hebrews is actually a sermon. It's not written like a letter, it's not written like an epistle, because it's a sermon. It's the first downloadable sermon that we have. And this author is exceptionally concerned about the Christians. We are talking about mature Christians. We're talking about people that's been following Christ for a while. We're talking about people that ought to be teachers. This is an elite group of people. But they were starting to fall away. Something was happening to them. And here now comes this letter. Here now comes the sermon. Here now comes this amazing portion of scripture in which God speaks to these people and is speaking to us today. And actually a very simple answer is given. The cure of making sure that you never walk away from Christ is very simple. The key is this. It is to realize and to know how amazing Christ is. Now that sounds like a very simple thing I'm saying. Do you go and leave and bring us back that portion of wisdom? Go back on leave, please. All right? But you know what? Christianity often gets reduced to something far less. It gets reduced to service. It gets reduced to doing things. It gets reduced to doing your bit. It gets reduced to people around us and what they're doing, what they're not doing. But in the end of the day, there can be only one thing, and that is the utter supremacy of Christ. Can I kick a holy cow for a moment, if that's okay? You know what's a holy cow? Holy cow, you know, some religions, you can't eat cows because they're holy. You can't eat them. So it's a holy cow. We never think about it. We never talk about it. It's a holy cow. All right? And it's like Tony Campolo once said, holy cows makes the best hamburgers. All right, so allow me to kick a holy cow for a moment. The holy cow currently in Western Christianity is that Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. Right? Am I right? No one questions that. No one ever says anything about it. Everyone accepts that. All right? Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. If you say anything contrary to that, you must be a legalist. It must be terrible. All right? Am I right? That's a holy cow. We don't touch it, we don't kick it, we allow it to graze wherever it wants to graze. Okay, am I right? I'm right. Of course I'm right. Come on. Come on. Don't look at me like that. You don't know what I'm going to say next, though, so you're a bit nervous. That's what holy cows does to you, right? You don't bite a holy cow because you're nervous. If you bite the holy cow, somebody's going to take you out, all right? So you're nervous now. What am I going to say? What I'm going to say is this. Where in the Bible does it actually say that it's a relationship? Neil's not here tonight, so we're in trouble. Think about it. Now, it is implied, of course. And I'm not saying, please don't get me wrong, I'm just playing a bit devil's advocate, which is the wrong thing to play in church. All right? Very wrong thing to play in church. I'm not saying it's not a relationship. Please don't misunderstand. I'm not saying it's not a relationship. I'm just saying relationship is a very interesting word because in that word, we can fill in virtually anything we'd like. You see, nowhere in the Bible does it say that Christianity is a relationship. It doesn't say that. It's implied. It's implied. And it certainly is a relationship, but the question is, what type of relationship is it? What is the quality of that relationship? And the Bible actually talks a lot about that. It says, remember when Jesus speaks to the woman at the well and he says, a time will come when people will worship. The quality of that relationship is worship. That is the type of relationship. Now, mostly in our mind, when we talk about relationship, we talk about coffee shop. All right, we sit down, we look at the menu, we order something strong, coffee-wise. You say something, I say something. We both feel better, we walk away. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't share with God. Please don't misunderstand me. Again, I'm just kicking the holy cow because I'm in the mood to do that. All right? But the Bible does talk a lot about the fact that the end result of what happens between us and God is worship. And what is worship? Is worship a song that you sing? I'm looking at Greg, but he's ignoring me. No. Greg says, no, it's not a song. The songs that you sing can be part of worship, but it's not worship. What is worship? Worship is adoring Christ. It's looking at Christ and having such respect for him, such awe for him, such affection for him, such love for him. Looking at him and saying, this is the most amazing person ever. This is the most amazing experience ever. John 1 starts and it says that Jesus is a monogenes, the Greek says, the only begotten, which is a lame translation. Monogenes means one of a kind. One of a kind. There is nothing like Christ. Our relationship with Christ, if it's not bound in worship, if it's not bound in a way of supremely regarding him, not bound in such a way of supremely being devoted to him, being in awe of him, then we have a wrong relationship with him. And what Hebrew teaches us, unless we truly embrace the supremacy of Christ, unless that becomes truly alive to us, Christianity inevitably becomes reduced to a something after a while that becomes meaningless. That becomes a question of, why am I doing this? You see, maybe if you're honest enough tonight, you would say, and you'd acknowledge to yourself, there's perhaps a phase, perhaps now, perhaps early in your life, but some of the stage in your life, of this life of following Christ, I'm pretty sure there was a time where you looked at yourself and you said, why on earth am I doing this? Right? Why am I doing this? And I'm pretty sure you asked that question because at that moment, in your relationship with Christ, it was not a relationship of worship. Christ became something very familiar to you. Very comfortable, perhaps. You know, like an old teddy bear. Like a rugby game on a Saturday. Very comfortable, nothing wrong with it, but not supreme, not one to be worshipped. What is your relationship with God? You see, I would venture to guess that for many of us, we get familiar with Christ. It's human nature. Ask married couples. It's human nature. After a while, you get familiar with somebody. After a while, you lose that wow factor. You ask yourself, now you're filling in blanks now, aren't you? You see, it takes something very focused not to be familiar with somebody. And even more so with God. So that's a question. Why are you a Christian? Why are you following Christ? Is it something that you're born into? Is it something that somebody else did? You know, I see so many people move to the city and they fall away from Christ because they embrace Christianity because a friend embraced Christianity. They embrace Christianity because a mother or father or brother or sister embraced Christianity. It was never their own. You see, in the city, you can't hide away. Because you're not all the time with people that's Christians. The question is, what is really yours? What is it that's truly, truly important to you? And Hebrews then starts off with it. And it says in Hebrews 1, and finally we're getting to the scriptures, finally. Hebrews 1, and it says so clearly about Christ and the uniqueness of Christ. Oh, I'm at Philemon. That's not going to help us. It says verse 3, the sun is the radiance, the sun, Jesus Christ, is the radiance of God's glory, and he is the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, remember that, we'll come back to that, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven, so he became as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is superior to theirs. This is the theme of the book of Hebrews. Christ is superior to all things. How superior is your Christ tonight? You see, you have some understanding of who Christ is and who's he not. I have some understanding of who he is and who is not. Now, the Bible says here in verse 3 that he is the exact representation. The Greek word that's used is the word character. You know, like you would have a character in an alphabet. It is the exact representation of the essence of God. When you look at Christ, he exactly shows us who God is. His exact representation. But now the question is, when you look at Christ, who is Christ to you? Who is Christ to you? How big is Christ to you? How superior is Christ to you? Now, what you think of Christ doesn't change who Christ is and who is not. It doesn't change. But it changes your relationship. It changes your relationship. And if we have an idea of anything less of who Christ is, the worship aspect of our relationship becomes less and less. And the moment we stop marveling at Christ, the moment we stop worshiping Christ, you know what we're left with? We're left with recipes. We're left with abstract things of who God is and who's not. We're left with things to do in church. We're left with the people in church and who they are and who they're not. You know, our Christianity has become reduced to just having church without God. Now, that might be putting it a bit extreme. But that's a danger that we run. That's a risk that we have. Christ is supreme in all things. But now the question is, how supreme is Christ? And that is what the book of Hebrews, the rest of the book of Hebrews, truly is about. How supreme is Christ? And there's just one aspect I'd like to focus on tonight. We don't have time for rest. We might come back to it. But there's just one aspect I'd like to focus on, and that is Hebrews 7. Now, what is interesting about Hebrews is that it talks a lot about the priesthood of Christ. It is unique in the way that it writes about the priesthood of Christ. Now, the word priest, we all understand the word priest. We have some idea of what is the word priest. We might lose some of the emotional impact and value to us because we don't live under a priesthood. All right? So, it seems a bit vague to us. What is the importance of a priesthood? And let me just say that for a moment and stop there for a moment as well. Now, to the audience, initially, to whom this book was written, this letter was written, or the sermon was written, they were absolutely focused on the importance of a priest. Now, at that stage in Israel, the priesthood has become reduced to something that is very much political, but the priesthood was central to everything that happened in Jewish life. All right. Before the exile, in the time of the kings, the king and the priest and the prophets were the three officers that ran the nation. After the exile happened, only the priest and the prophet remained, and 400 years before Christ, the prophet fell away. And only the priest was left. And the priesthood was a connection to the earlier days of Israel. And therefore, within the priesthood was a very political connection. The high priest was the most powerful Jewish person at that stage. And often the Jewish people were ruled by outside powers, like the Romans or Babylonians or Greeks for a short while. And the priests were the only stabilizing factor at that stage. Now, whoever controlled the priesthood controlled Jewish life. The priest was the most important person. Now, when the author of Hebrews writes about the priesthood, every Jewish Christian would recognize the importance of this. I mean, even Paul, remember the book of Acts when he was slapped because he was speaking to the high priest? He didn't go like, hey, I'm not under the law anymore. I'm going to say to you whatever I like. He didn't say that. He apologized. He said, I did not realize that I'm speaking to the high priest. Book of Acts, remember that incident? Go and read it if you're unsure what I'm talking about. All right. So the priesthood, and especially the high priest, a lot of power was invested in that. But unfortunately, it became very political, and hence it was reduced from what it was meant to be. Very political, but not much else. What was it meant to be, though? And I think that's what we should start off with and should understand. Now, when the author of Hebrews writes and he says, listen, Christ as priest, he is saying Christ is the most important person. He says Christ has got the central role that ties everything together. But what is the understanding of it? What is the importance of it? Now, Greg did me a huge favor by playing that song about I'm undone. Here in your presence, I am undone. Thank you, Greg, for playing that song. All right, why do I thank him for playing that song? You know where that song comes from? It comes from Book of Isaiah, chapter 6, where Isaiah had a vision of God, and then he said, woe is me. Woe is me. And the intention there is that he's saying, I am undone. I am undone. I'm a people from a people of unclean lips. Now, the literal translation, undone, we don't use that word so much anymore. I am undone. I don't know if anyone put a Facebook status update like that on recently. I am undone. And then he goes, oh, don't worry, Friday is tomorrow. Okay, no, I haven't seen that in a while. So it's not a word that we use quite often, undone. What does it mean? Literally, it means to be unraveled at the seams. It means to come apart. When Isaiah said that, he had a nervous breakdown. Now, just hang on for a moment because I'm taking a bit of a detour here. I'm still talking about priesthood. I'm talking about the supremacy of Christ. And I'm going to link that as Christ as a priest. Okay? Everyone still with me? I'm taking a bit of a detour. And I want to talk about the importance of a priest. Now, where I'm starting with is this interesting reality that we find all the time in the Old Testament and some places in the New Testament, where people meet God and what happens to them. So Isaiah met God and he had a nervous breakdown. That doesn't sound good for a Sunday service, does it? Now that's interesting because Isaiah, I mean, he is the prince of the prophets, many commentators call him. I mean, he wrote probably the most polished poetry, prophetic poetry. He has, in the Old Testament, the most references to Christ and who Christ is and how he would look and what would happen. I mean, some people even call it the fifth gospel. And he lived 700 years before Christ. We're talking about the man. All right? You know how he died? He was sawed, we don't know that for sure, but according to tradition, he was sawed in two with a wooden saw because of his devotion to God. Ugh. That is not a good end. That was his devotion to God. We're talking about amazing man here. We're talking about a prophet of prophets. Okay? We're talking about the man. And what happens to him is when he meets God. Now, isn't it interesting that it's only in chapter 6 that he meets with God? So what does it mean? Does it mean chapter 1 to 5 was written before he had that vision of God? What does it mean? We don't know. And is it not interesting that he then immediately says, I am of unclean lips. In other words, everything that I've said is completely stupid now that I've seen God. Throw away the books. Throw away everything that you've heard of me because now I'm seeing God and I'm having a nervous breakdown because he is much bigger, much more terrifying. He says, woe is me. Woe is me means I am cursed. When the prophets spoke against something, they would say, woe to. Jesus spoke to the towns. He says, woe to, and the towns were destroyed. All right? Prophets normally would either speak a blessing, blessed is, or they'd speak a curse, woe is. And when they spoke a curse, something supernatural happened and that thing was cursed. He cursed himself when he saw God. Woe is me. If you go to Hebrews 12, don't worry, we're getting to the good news. I always start off with the bad news. Hebrews 12, look at what it says. Verse 22, let's read a couple of verses to get going, to warm up for Hebrews 7. But you have come, verse 22, but you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You have come to the thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all men, to the spirits of righteous men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator, priest, remember that, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. See to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. If I did not escape when they refused him who warned them on the earth, how much less will we if we turn away from him who warns us from heaven? At that time his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised once more, I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. The words once more indicate the removing of what can be shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. There's classically three statements of God is. God is spirit, God is love, and God is a consuming fire. Currently, of those three, we only focus on one, God is love. God is spirit means God is radically different from us. God is fire means that God is terrifying. He's a consuming fire. Isaiah met him, and it was terrifying too. Another person that met him was Job. We don't like that book either. Job, in effect, cursed himself as well. I have heard, but now I've seen, and I'm left in dust and ashes. I'm left reduced to rubble because I've seen our God. Who else saw God? Moses. Moses saw the back of God, and God said, I will only reveal my goodness to you. Because, hey, you're 80 years old, you must live some time still. Okay, you didn't catch my joke there. He wouldn't have made it. You see, to meet with God, we inherently know, is a terrifying thing. Because God is holy and we're not. God is different from us. God is perfect. Uzziah but touched the ark as he was traveling back to Jerusalem, and he died. Another Uzziah, the king, that worshipped in the temple and decided to do sacrifices in the temple in the place he shouldn't go in the presence of God, he became leprous and he died. You see, initially, a priesthood was not necessary. Adam and Eve didn't have a priest, did they? They could meet with God wherever they wanted and however they wanted. But since the fall of man, we couldn't just go into the presence of God, because God is holy and God is a consuming fire, which is to say that if we get too close to him in how we are, we will not survive it. It would be a terrifying thing. Book of Revelations describes when people meet God without Christ, and it says that they would crawl into whatever hole they can find. Caves, holes in the ground. Let the earth swallow us up, they will say, according to the book of Revelations. It is a terrifying thing. Which is to say that we need a mediator to come to God. We can't come to God on our own. We need a mediator. We need somebody that allows us to go in. Because we can't go in on our own. And you see, that is not a solution either. A solution is not to go in. That is not a solution either. Because eventually we have to meet with God. God is an utter reality. And reality is that which we must deal with. That is called reality. That's a very philosophical definition, Dallas Willard. Reality is what you have to deal with. You don't have a choice. You have to deal with it. Reality. You can't avoid it. And God is an utter reality. You can't avoid God. You can avoid him for a year, for 2 years, for 3 years, for 20 years, for 80 years, but you cannot avoid him forever. He is an utter reality. And what then? You see, you can't meet with God. You can't enter with God, but you have to. So what then? And that is the idea of priesthood. Priesthood is a person. Priesthood, a priest, is a person that makes it possible for you to meet with God. And Christ is the ultimate priest. Christ is the ultimate priest. And on that basis alone, Christ is supreme. That's not the only basis. It's not the only basis of his supremacy. But even if that was the only basis, that would make him utterly supreme as well. Now, Hebrews 7 talks about that, and we're going to look a bit at that tonight, and then we're going to stop there. Everyone still with me? Yes. Thanks, Bernie. Bernie gives a thumbs up. Right, let's go. All right. By the way, a small group did a great job on that hall. It looks amazing. Snacks, all that. Let's get going. All right. Verse 15. Let me spare you the previous verses. Verse 15. And what we have said is even more clear if another priest like Melchizedek appears. One who has become a priest not on the basis of a regulation as to his ancestry, but on the basis of a power of an indestructible life. For it is declared, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. The former regulation is set aside because it was weak and useless. For the law made nothing perfect, and a better hope is introduced by which we draw near to God. And it was not without an oath. Others became priests without any oath, but he became a priest with an oath when God said to him, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever. Because of his oath, Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant. Now there were many of those priests, since death prevented them from continuing in office. But because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely, our translation says, utterly or to the uttermost, those who come to God through him, because he always lived to intercede for them. Such a high priest meet our need, one who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. Unlike the other high priests, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day, first to his own sins and then for the sins of his people. He sacrificed for their sins once for all when he offered himself. For the law appoints as high priest men who are weak, but the oath which came after the law appointed the Son who has been made perfect forever. Very complicated. Let's look at that. The basis of a priesthood of Christ. Now, just turn to somebody next to you and just say, okay, time for the good news. All right. Just so you're aware of where we are now in the sermon, time for the good news. All right, we're done with the hard news. Time for the good news now. All right. So, ever since the dawn, by the way, the two oldest professions, three oldest professions, I think, known to mankind, farmer and hunter, let's put that together, priest, prostitute. All right, interesting. Think a bit about that, but let's leave it at that. Since the dawn, man has realized that we need to be able to approach God, but we don't know how, and we don't know who this God is. So through the years, many false priests and many weak priests has arisen. The book of Hebrews is very honest here. It says, weak and useless. Thank you so much. Weak and useless. There are many priests. There are many priests today. You know what I mean with that? I mean, there's many, many promises of how you can approach God. And listen, I'm not just talking about other religions. I'm even talking about Christianity. There's only one way to approach God, and that is through Christ. You see, Christ is all and in all. There is nothing more than Christ, and there's nothing less than Christ. Christ is everything, until he fills everything in every way. Did I put enough everything in every way now so we all get that point? There are many priests. There are many priests that promises many things. And even in Christianity, you're going to get many promises of ways in which you can circumvent Christ. Ways in which you can force God's arm to do something for you if you just follow the right method. If you just do the right thing. If you just go to the right church. Those things are weak and useless. There's only one priest worthy, and that is Christ. So my question is, what is your priest? When you enter the presence of God, when you pray, when you worship, when you seek the face of God, how do you do it? How do you do it? Now, I'm not asking you how you should do it. I'm asking you, how are you doing it? Are you doing it on the basis of how long you've been a Christian? Are you doing it on the basis of what you've done and what you've not done? Are you doing it on the basis of what? See, there's only one worthy priest, and that is Christ. Now, we're talking about the supremacy of Christ, and we're talking about one aspect of the supremacy of Christ, and that is his priesthood. He is the true priest. Through him, something terrifying, Mount Sinai, the thunder, the fire, the judgment of God, becomes something glorious, Mount Zion, Hebrews 12, of countless joy. Of angels and angels, myriads of angels gathered together worshiping God. Something terrifying becomes something truly, truly welcoming because of his priesthood. Because he allows me to go into the throne room of God. May it be said of me, may it be said of you that I never try and enter the throne room of God on my own. How's that? We serve a magnificent God. See, what all this language of Christianity's relationship has robbed us, it's robbed us of the majesty and the magnificence of God. You see, a coffee date can mean a lot for me, but it's not going to solve my problems. It's going to help me vent a bit. Okay, I vented. But it's not going to solve my problems. It's not going to make me see something so vast, so big, that any problem, every problem becomes nothing.
See, because that's what true worship does for you. It puts you in contact with God that is so big, so vast, that everything else becomes small fries. Too blessed to be stressed. The true priest. Now, the basis of the immensity of a priesthood of Christ, four things that it says here, and I'm quickly going to run through it because I'm running out of time. The first thing that it says is that Christ is superior to any other priest out there, whether it's a Jewish priest, whether it's the forms of priesthood that we see today. He's superior to any of those priests because of the indestructible life that he has. You see, many people try and use pastors as priests. The only thing is this. What can I give you? Not much. If you're dependent on me as a priest, you'll not get much. You'll get Afrikaans accent. You'll get an amazing wife. That counts for something. Counts for something. You'll be a bit weird about rugby. You'll lose your hair. But you'll not get much. Because I'm also weak and useless. Yes, I am. But the type of life that Christ has is an indestructible life. Cannot be destroyed. And if you trust on Christ as your priest, if you truly rely on him, if you truly worship him, if you truly throw yourself upon him, the life that you will inherit is indestructible. It means whatever comes against you will not destroy you. The life within you will destroy it. Not you, the life in you. There's a difference. We see it as me. Superman. I'm putting on my suit. Man of Steel. No underpants these days, I see. That part is gone. Just have a monosuit with a cape. All right? Superman. I'm not Superman. So if something comes against me, I'm going to go like, and it's gone. It's sorted. It's fixed. No. It's a life in you. It's indestructible. It's indestructible. You try and kill it, no worries. It lives. You try and put it in a box, no worries. It lives. It's indestructible. It's indestructible. And what a freeing thought that is, the life that you are given, not that you have of your own, not the life that you work to have, a life that is given to you because of Christ as a mediator, is indestructible. It doesn't mean it will not have difficulty, by the way. It didn't say effortless life. It doesn't say that. It says indestructible life. It says when difficulties get thrown at you, you go like, I'm going to outgrow it. Because that's what life does. Life lives, life grows. Indestructible life. The first quality of Christ is that he's indestructible. He is crucified and the grave cannot hold him. No other priest can save it. No other priest can save it. No other mediator can save it. The quality of life of God, of Christ, is indestructible. And therefore, he's superior to anything else. Listen, I'm not knocking the church, but I want to be honest and serious about this. You're going to forget the sermon. It doesn't do much for my esteem, all right? My self-esteem. But you're going to forget it. A sermon, a something, is not going to save you. But Christ is. At best, the sermon points to Christ, and then I did my job and I can go home. Christ is everything. Indestructible life. Do you depend on a book or sermon or person to give you indestructible life? See, there's too many people relying on other people to give them indestructible life, and they can't because they are weak and useless as well. Yes, you can embrace it tonight. I'm not going to make you turn to somebody else and say, you are weak and useless. I'm not going to do that, okay? I'm not going to do that. And I'm not going to ask you to look in the mirror tonight and go like, you are weak and useless, but I love you nonetheless. But you might as well do that because it's true at least. It's true. But life that Christ has is indestructible. And it's given. It's given. And therefore, he's a superior priest. Therefore, he's the only priest. Therefore, whatever we do points towards Christ and it has life, or does not point to him and it has death. There's nothing in between. Either in your small group, you're growing closer to Christ, or death is entering it. Either in your worship, you're growing closer to Christ, and goosebumps does not mean you're growing closer to Christ. You're growing closer to Christ when you start looking like Christ. When you start bearing fruit. How do you know a tree? You'll know about fruit. And you see, that happens. It happens because we're growing closer to Christ. Everything must lead to growing closer to Christ, or it has no value. No value at all. See, either your marriage is making you growing closer to Christ, or death is entering it. See, many people are experiencing death at their work. Okay, just an honesty moment here. Let's breathe. Let's breathe. Life is good. Good news part. Many people complain over work. Lots of people come and see me about their work. Because your work is never about Christ. Never about Christ. And I'm not saying you should bash the next person next to you with a Bible. You know, they go like, good morning, how was your week? Tuh! You know? I'm not saying that's what you should do. Sorry, I had to put one tuh in there. Sorry. Forgive me. I'm a bit weird. Luckily, I'm not your priest. I'm not saying you should do that. But I'm just saying, if your work is never about Christ and seeking Christ and knowing Christ, well, then death will enter it. Doesn't matter what you do. Doesn't matter what you do. Isn't it weird how you start with a job, you go like, oh, this is the most amazing job ever. And 3 years later, you go like, oh, I wish I never did this. Listen, it's true for everything. You will enter a relationship and go like, yo, you're the best buddy ever. BFF. All right? Right. And then 3 years later, I don't know, what's a cool abbreviation for that? Biggest loser ever, I don't know what. Death will enter anything that Christ is not in, because whatever Christ is not in is weak and useless. What has indestructible life? Everything must lead close to its Christ, the supremacy of Christ. That is the first thing. The second thing is this. Good news. Good news. Listen, why is it good news that it's Christ's indestructible life? Because then it's not dependent on me. And thank God it's not dependent on me. I'm so glad I don't have to do the self-up thing of pumping myself up every day and going like, you're so hot. Looking myself in the mirror, you're so hot. You have more hair than you really think you do. All right? I'm going to do this. You are the most amazing pastor ever. Yes, you are. All right? Now, let's go to work. All right? I'm so thankful I don't have to do that, because inevitably it feels like a bit of a lie, doesn't it? But I can look in the mirror and I can say, I have indestructible life in me through Christ Jesus. Hair loss? You will not break me. I will outgrow you. Yeah. Amen. Grappies. Sorry. Let's get back to serious stuff. Okay. Now, so that's the first thing. It's good news. Indestructible life. It's not dependent on me. Second thing is an oath that is made. What it's talking about is that the other priests, they become priests because their dads were priests. And they were priests. So, what are you going to do one day when you get out of school? I'm going to be a priest. Why? My dad is a priest. Okay. All right. They had to do it. They had no choice. They did it. With Christ, it's different. There's an oath that is made over him. And it says, you are a priest forever. Now, when you tie yourself to something, when you have to say, this will happen, how do you do that? Often what you'll do is you'll make an oath. Or in our context, you'll sign a contract. In God's case, the strongest thing that he has is an oath. When he speaks, it is. He cannot go back on it. So when he says, there is light, there is light. He said, it's light, so it is light. He can't go back on it. Whatever he says is. That's how strong his word is. And this is not even his word, this is an oath. which is to say that if God would go back on this, he would cease to be God and the universe would cease to be and there would be nothing at all. That is pretty drastic. So God makes an oath, and that is the difference. You see, with Christ, he is fully approved of God. You can never go wrong with Christ. You can never go wrong. You can never go, I missed it. You can never go, I've been cheated in some way. Because Christ is the fullness of God. Let me tell you what, for people that's been follows Christ, after a while, they get tempted to start adding things to Christ. Yes, it's fine to be a Christian. Christ is fine. But you know what I discovered? Let me show you something cool. Something and Christ. And it's happening more and more. There is nothing more than Christ. An oath has been made over him. You are a priest forever. Whenever you're putting something next to Christ, you're putting something weak and useless there. And that will not save you. That will not save you. It's only Christ. I tell you why we do that though. We get bored with Christ, which speaks more of our hearts than it speaks of Christ. Yo, I'm very honest here tonight. Should I go and leave again? All right. That's one reason. The other reason is if Christ is my mediator, it means I must go to Christ. It means somebody else is not going to fix it for you. Only Christ will fix it for you. There's only one mediator between God and man. 2 Timothy says, Paul writes, there's only one mediator between God and man, Jesus Christ. There's only one person that can solve your problems. I can't solve your problems. I can't even solve my own problems. And the same is true for you. There's only Christ. There's only one mediator. But then go to him. Go to him. The Romans had an interesting way of putting the name of a priest. It's the word bridge they put in there. Pontifex. The Latin word. Bridge. You must walk that bridge. God makes an oath. You will never be disappointed when Christ is your priest. Because God places him there forever. All right, I'm not going to go into the imagery of Melchizedek. I'm going to skip that maybe for next time. The third thing that it says there, and I'm almost done, I promise, is that Christ, verse 23, now there were many of those priests since death prevented them from continuing in office, but because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood. Christ is superior because his life is indestructible. Christ is superior because God approves him by oath. And Christ is superior because he is forever a priest. Remember when I said there wasn't priests before Adam and Eve? Because priests were not necessary. Is that not interesting? But Christ adopts is the right word. The function of the office as a priest forever, and he lives to intercede for you. Now people come and go. People come and go. People that give influence in your life, they come and go. Your small group leader might not be your small group leader in a short while. I might not be your pastor in a short while. Who knows? You might not be here in a short while. Who knows? There's only one constant. Christ. He will never leave you. He'll never forsake you. When he ascends to the heavens, he said to the disciples and he says to us, see, I am with you even to the end of the age. See, Christ never changes. He's immutable. He never grows old. He never grows tired of you. He never sleeps. He never slumbers. He's constant. He is a constant high priest. And thank God for that. Thank God I don't have to seek another priest. Oh my goodness, I ran out of a priest. Now I'm going to seek another priest. Are you a good priest? I don't know. Let's see. Christ is priest forever. Lives to intercede for us. Thank God for that. So why are we always so fearful and anxious? You know, at least once a year or at least twice a year, all kinds of prayers start popping out about fear. Right? Intercessors. Right? Once a year, twice a year. It's all kinds of prayers that start popping out about fear. People start getting fearful and anxious. Understand why? Because we are frail and we are human. I am fearful many times. But theologically speaking, I have no reason to fear. Because Christ is faithful. He will never leave me, never forsake me. He prays for me. He lives to intercede for you and for I. How many times do you pray? How many times does Christ pray for you? And that is the good news. If God had to measure my prayers, Tiens would be in trouble. You know, life at Wang scale, but if you put Christ's prayers on top of that, things start happening. Forever, he is my priest. Forever, he is my connection with God. Forever, he is the reason why I can enter the throne room of God. He is a superior priest. And then lastly, and we're going to stop there tonight, as I've said many myriad times before. The last reason why he's such a superior priest is because his sacrifice is so superior. Verse 26, such a high priest meet our need, one who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. Unlike the other high priest, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day, first for his own sin, then for the sins of his people. He sacrificed for his own sins once for all, for their sins, sorry, once for all, when he offered himself. His sacrifice is so superior. See, the problem with the other sacrifices, you've got to do it again and again. To feel that you have a relationship with God. So you had to sacrifice a goat, and then a bull, and then a chicken, and then a dove. Everything that moves gets sacrificed. All right? And we're like, oh my goodness. A bull only lasts 3 months. I must take another bull. A chicken lasts a week, a dove a day. So I'm in trouble. All right? Forget about Pick and Pay. Forget about Spar. Go and kill that dove. I mean, it must have been in bloodbath in there. I mean, tough stuff. The sacrifice of Christ is so superior, he sacrificed himself, that it lasts forever. Forever our sin is covered. It does not take our responsibility away to grow in holiness. Please don't misunderstand what I'm saying here. But it means it's always enough. You see, we said that a slight bit earlier, and I do find this a lot, that we have such a fear to approach God the Father. We are afraid of him many times. So what we do is we start talking about him as a father only, and we don't talk about him as a judge. We try and reduce that aspect, the terrible aspect of God. We try and reduce that until he's a dad that buys you, buys you whatever toys you want. And in the process, we reduce God, and we shouldn't do that. God is not less. God is not a judge, son. And I'm thankful that he's a judge, because we do need justice upon this earth. But if I ask for justice, I will get justice, and then I'm done. Thank you for coming. So that's a catch-22. If I don't ask for justice, everything goes to the dogs. If I do ask for justice, I get judged as well. Worst prayer you can pray. God, please judge the situation. Don't pray that. Because if God judges something, he judges everything. Which means he's going to judge you as well. You see, and we're aware of that. We know that. There's no one here that goes like, ah, whatever. No, we're all aware of that. And in the back of our mind, we're always wondering when the grace is going to run out. So we try and do more. We try and perform. We try and be better for the wrong reasons. Being better is great. Doing more is great. But for the wrong reasons, it's not great. But his sacrifice is superior. It never runs out. Never runs out. I mean, let's stand. Let's bring ourselves before God. Enough preaching for one day. I just want to ask the band to come to the front as well. We're going to sing a worship song. And my request to you is actually very simple tonight. If in your life, you realize tonight, I've lost a sense of the supremacy of Christ, the amazingness, the wowness of Christ. And I really just want to connect with Christ again tonight. Tonight, I don't want to pray about all my sins and all my stuff and all that what somebody else does and somebody this does and that does. But I've realized I've really grown cold in understanding the supremacy of Christ, in embracing the supremacy of Christ. And the best way for you knowing that is through your worship. Do you worship God? Do you not worship God? Then tonight we need to pray together. Amen? So that's what I'm going to ask. And we're just going to sing a worship song. And if that's you tonight, please come to the front so we can pray with you. Amen.